Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Healthcare Act, Medicaid, and Coercion Edition. Thank you for tuning in. This podcast will be moderated by Dean Reuter, the Director of the Practice Groups at the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. He will introduce the podcast and our speakers.
On March 28, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Florida versus Department of Health and Human Services and the National Federation of Independent Businesses versus Sebelius, two of the three cases before the court involving the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010, sometimes referred to as Obamacare or the Health Care Act. A common question raised in these two cases is whether Congress can lawfully withhold federal Medicaid funds from states that do not comply with the requirements of the Health Care Act, or whether this amounts to unlawful coercion. Both cases also raised the question whether, if the individual mandate requiring Americans to obtain health insurance or pay a penalty is deemed unconstitutional, the remainder of the Health Care Act still survives. That issue will be the subject of a separate podcast. To discuss the coercion issue, we have Professor Richard Epstein, New York University School of Law, and Professor Emeritus at the University of Chicago Law School, and Mr. Michael Greva, who is the John G. Searle Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of our speakers. And now, first, we have Professor Richard Epstein.
I think the first thing to note is what the actual arrangements are that are being discussed. It's quite clear that for many, many years, the United States has supplied the states under voluntary arrangements with certain funds to be used for Medicaid, that is, the administration of health care for needy and for poor. It is also equally clear that the only way in which you could make these grants intelligent is to subject them to certain kinds of conditions about the way in which the particular money can be spent. Up until the recent Obamacare situation, nobody has challenged the conditions that have been imposed upon the grant. Everybody has assumed that they've been germane. The situation has changed, however, with the Obamacare-type situations under the ACA, because now what happens is the grants read as follows. What you will do is to take the money that we're going to supply you, and it's a very large portion of the total cost, administer it at your expense, and expand the coverage of Medicare to cover people who are basically between 100 and 133% of the poverty line. And all of that seems to be just fine with respect to the money that's being given. The kicker under these circumstances is that if you decide not to take this particular money, to use it for this particular purpose, at your expense in terms of administration, then what will happen is you'll have to forfeit all the money that you receive on Medicare in order to run the programs that exist for the people who are currently at or below the poverty line. And the question that one has to ask is, when you impose a condition of this sort, does that amount to unconstitutional coercion, an infringement in the liberties of the state? And the argument, I think, is very difficult to make in that way if one accepts the decision which is now on the books of South Dakota against Dole. And that was a decision which said that if you wish to receive all of your highway monies in the states, you have to agree to have a statewide drinking limit of 21 years of age, otherwise you forfeit 5% of the money. And the reason why the government did this one through a conditional grant was that it was barred under the 21st Amendment from the direct regulation of drinking age inside the states, so it attached this particular condition. And what the Supreme Court said through Justice Rehnquist, the Chief Justice at the time, was that this is a mere encouragement rather than a form of coercion. There were two dissents, a very short one by Justice Brennan, which said, as far as I'm concerned, this is circumvention of the limitations on the 21st Amendment and should not be allowed, and a much longer account by Justice O'Connor, who tried to explain why it is that when you use these sorts of conditions, it was in fact ultimately coercive. I believe that she was right in the way in which you handled this particular case. The effort to try and figure out the difference between encouragement on the one hand and coercion on the other by figuring out the percentage of money that is withheld is a dead loser. By the time you get done with this, it turns out nobody can tell you where the one turns into the other, so virtually any amount of threat to withhold any amount of money is going to be regarded as fine. The correct line between coercion on the one hand and encouragement on the other is if you want to encourage somebody, you offer them something that you own. You don't promise to take something that they own, which is less valuable than something else. So in my view, it's coercion to go up to somebody and say either it's your money or your life, and it's equally coercive to say it's either your life or 5% of your money, which is what the Dole-type situation did. Now, when we come here to this particular case, the nature of the coercion is really quite extraordinary. The government has the power to decide whatever taxes it wants to recover from the citizens of any particular state. It can raise those things more or less at will. And then what it does is it says that we're going to keep all this money off the table unless you wish to go forward with a program in the way in which we want to state it. This is a vastly different from a situation where the government is trying to impose a condition upon you to make sure that the money you spend from them is not wasted. It's even much different from a situation which says, look, if you want to get this money, you have to match it with some other money of your own, because all the states will be in a position to turn it down if, by a few series of few calculations, the total money they get from both state and federal sources turn out to be worth less to them than the state money that they have. But in this particular case, in order to make this thing go, you have to turn down $25 billion if you're a state of California in order to avoid the government mandate. That money then goes to other states, so there's a massive redistribution between states. If, in fact, you accept the condition, there's nothing which says that the current program, which is relatively generous to the states, and that the federal government picks up all the money until about 2018 or so, and then 90% of it thereafter, leaving you only with the administrative states, that's not going to last. They can change it. So that the moment you permit this kind of leverage, it seems to me that you have a very, very serious kind of question of coercion. Or to put it in slightly different terms, when you're thinking about this in terms of the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions, what you ought to do is to think of this as an antitrust analogy. It's commonly understood in antitrust law that you're not allowed to leverage a dominant position, which the federal government has here, by imposing various kinds of unreasonable tie-in arrangements. And the whole point of this is to try to figure out the difference between those kinds of conditions that can be imposed, which advance the overall efficiency of the system, and those which simply allow somebody to control this situation and to leverage their power into areas where they ought not to move. If you grant this particular ability to withhold all taxes, if somebody does not comply with the Medicaid mandate, then in effect you can lower the percentages, you can force states to make appropriations into programs that are dictated by the federal government. Justice Kennedy and many others have spoken about the importance of the federalism in terms of the protection of individual liberty, and the best way in which to understand that is to understand that the moment you start seeing practices which would be condemned as monopolistic and done by private parties, these ought to be condemned as illegal, coercive when done by the federal government, and by that test, the mandate ought to fail. The lower courts on this, just to close, never addressed the incoherence associated with the Dole decision. In fact, what they tried to do is to explain why it is that it dictated this case. But if Dole is wrong, and it surely is as a matter of first theory, the Supreme Court should take this occasion to correct it and then to stop this kind of accretion. The federal government, if it wants to impose these kinds of additional benefits or burdens, it can do so through general revenues and general taxation. It doesn't have to resort to this kind of gimmick. Thank you.
Mr. Greva, your response, please.
The first thing I think that our listeners should understand, this is an argument among friends and co-authors. There's a lot of agreement between the two of us, and so let me try to identify two of those points. One of them is that South Dakota versus Dole is itself deeply problematic and will go nowhere. The second point of agreement is on the pernicious political economy of these programs. There is something, I hesitate to call it coercive, but it's very awkward for the states to be in a position where saying no to any particular funding program, especially a funding program as comprehensive as Medicaid, has no effect other than that the same amount of money will then be distributed to other states. And I'll have a little more to say about that later on. Having said that, it's understandable, it seems to me, why the state plaintiffs in this particular case handled the challenge the way they did, based on South Dakota versus Dole. Just as a matter of pure strategy, they had to distinguish this particular arrangement in the Patient Protection Act from any other conditional funding program that went before or can ever be conceived, because this case is big enough as it is without taking on the entire entitlement state and making the court ask, well, if we strike down this, then what else will happen down the road? And that's a very, very, very difficult task. There are basically two tacks that the plaintiffs have here. One is to say, well, what's unique about this thing is it's tied to the individual mandate in another title of the Act. And that's a very, very complicated argument. I don't believe it'll succeed, especially not if the Supreme Court, in another piece of this case, severs the individual mandate from the Medicaid statute. So that's one. And the other strategy is to say this is compulsory and coercive because we are, in fact, locked into these programs because of our past commitment to them. So if we now say no to the Medicaid expansion, all our Medicaid money is gone. That we can't do to our own citizens, and is particularly coercive in light of the fact that the program is so big and our taxpayers pay into the program one way or the other, and then the money goes elsewhere if we say no. And that's, as a practical matter, completely impossible. What is one to make of that argument? I don't think it'll go anywhere, and I'm not terribly sympathetic to it as a basic matter, and here is why. So the unconditional conditions analogy, it seems to me, works only for things if you take things from the state that are the state's own. But this is not Europe. This is the United States of America. We do not tax states. We tax citizens. Is the federal government allowed to do that? Yes, it is, pursuant to its taxing powers, to a very large extent with very few limitations. Can it then spend the money and attach conditions to the expenditure of its own funds? And the answer to that is, again, yes. It is completely true, and Richard is completely right, that that introduces a bizarre and pernicious kind of asymmetry into these programs that creates all sorts of bargaining risks, all kinds of terrible federalism consequences. What separates us here is I just don't see the constitutional objection or limitation on it. There are limitations on federal conditional funding programs. None of them apply to this program, in my estimation, and I'd be happy to explain why in our forthcoming banter.
Professor Epstein, a quick response?
Michael has basically hit, I think, but it's the hardest point in this particular situation, which is whether or not when you impose coercion upon citizens of the state rather than upon the state itself, does that somehow the change and to transform the overall situation? And, you know, my own view about that is it should not be regarded as decisive because it turns out that every single danger that you're worried about in terms of the operation of the federal system apply with equal force if the monies are collected directly from the state on the one hand or from all of its citizens on the other. Every time you increase the amount of taxes that you collect through the federal government, you reduce the options that are available to the state. And when you do this, in addition, what happens is in order to match these things, what you're going to have to do as you start moving down is to tax your own citizens further and to reorient your internal state priorities in order to meet the Medicaid monster, which is going to be imposed.
But before you go on, let's see what Michael Grieva has to say about that point.
I agree with almost all of that, except it's worse. And it's worse in the following sense. It's not that the states willy-nilly opt into these things. It's when the federal government puts money on the table that is derived in the way Richard just described, the states say, hoorah. State officials say, hoorah, hoorah, hoorah. Let's take the money. And the more generous you make the money, the federal grant, the more they will be inclined, because they have short-time horizons that don't extend past their tenure in office, to accept the money and to spend their own citizens into oblivion or to tax their own citizens.
What's ironic is about that, and I think it's worth mentioning again, is that all the Democratic officials are quite happy with this deal, all the Republicans somehow or other are not. And, you know, what one could easily see about this is not craziness. We know from watching the waivers work under the individual mandate, when you have a blue national government, which is Democrat, you get more waivers for Democratic states, you get more waivers for labor unions than you get for red states or for company kinds of plans. So you could easily see somebody thinking, if you're a Democrat, we're going to do very, very well under this kind of thing. We're now cooperators when it comes to our relationship to Washington. They'll be warm and toasty, and these other guys are not going to be that way. So I think that we both see the enormous political risks associated with this. And I'm just going to mention one thing. The whole discussion is crazy as a matter of original constitutional design, because if you look at what is said, it is said that when you talk about the spending power, you have the power to tax and spend, and it's to pay for public debts, the general welfare, and the common defense of the United States. All of these were meant to be expenditures for public goods. Individual transfer payments between two individuals are the absolute antithesis of what a public good is. So if you're trying to think about this in terms of original design, the very nature of the spending clause was so limited to make sure that transfer payments would never be included. And we get this new definition of public interest, that which affects large numbers of people, and therefore we can now bring ourselves to do absolutely anything. You know, I would like that originalist argument to hold, but as Michael says, that would end every one of the modern federal entitlement programs, which in many ways would be a good thing if you were writing on a blank slate, but it's almost impossible to implement after you've been running this engine furiously for the past 75 years or so, depending on when you start.
What about that, Mr. Grieve?
Let me emphasize two points for our listeners that I think are important here. To put this in a different way, what these programs, these conditional funding programs, create is sort of bilateral monopoly bargaining risks, right? And what you need is a test that is sensitive to the monopoly risks on both sides. So what Richard has emphasized is the monopoly risks on the federal side and the games federal officials will be inclined to play with these kinds of things. What I wanted to add is that this risk runs both ways. And what one has to understand is that Medicaid is on the ropes with or without Obamacare because states over the past 40 years have voluntarily expanded Medicaid in an effort to attract additional federal funds because the bargain looks so cheap. It doesn't look cheap anymore, and that is why we're at this impasse. The second thing that is important to understand, I think, about this is that it, in very, very important ways, the risks here are tied to the introduction of a federal income tax. So long as you ran a federal tariff-financed economy, the money looked just like a free pot of money, which was sort of handed out for all sorts of purposes. The imbalances and asymmetries we've discussed come precisely from the fact that the money is taxed from citizens in individual states. You can't identify it, and then the imbalances and asymmetries become very, very obvious. The reason why it's so hard to go up against that and to argue against it is you have to argue in the teeth or you have to argue about and against the original settlement of or the original analysis of this problem in 1923 by Justice Sutherland.
You're talking about the Massachusetts against Mellon.
Yes. And so this was about one of the very earliest experimental conditional funding programs. The way Justice Sutherland, in a unanimous opinion, or unanimous opinions, I should say, analyzed this is, look, the money comes from the taxpayers. They have no reason to complain about the imposition. And on the flip side, the money is dispensed not to individuals, but to a state. And if the state feels compelled by this or imposed upon, the easy answer is don't yield to this form of incentive or compulsion.
Yeah,
and it's that analysis that has remained orthodox. I, for one, think this big, humongous, this aircraft carrier of a statute is simply the wrong case to take on that kind of argument. But
well,
I completely agree with Richard that going forward, one has to think about it. And one of the great, great things about Paul Clement's brief in this case is it puts the political, the nasty political economy of these statutes front and center and at least allows us at long last to have an open debate about it. And what I hope going forward is that if the Supreme Court and when the Supreme Court says 9-0 to the states and Paul Clement, you have no case here, that we don't sort of then sit around and say, oh, once again, the Supreme Court has ignored federalism, but we should take that as the opening salvo to a much larger debate.
Okay, Professor Epstein, before you respond, let me give you each, 60 seconds to express a final thought or to sum up. Richard, you first.
I might take a bit more because Michael said so much. Look, the first thing I want to state is that there is a way of doing this case relatively surgically. The first thing to note is I've never seen a program, and Medicaid has never resorted to a situation where all funding given will be held hostage to the willingness to comply to a given situation. So you don't have to disrupt any other program by saying you can't go this far. The argument here is exactly parallel to that with the original mandate. There are all sorts of ways in which you can go through conventional channels in order to achieve these goals, and the fact that on both these provisions, on the mandate and on the Medicaid expansion program, they're resorting to unprecedented unprecedented tactics, which they are, is a good reason to say this far and no further. When I wrote my amicus briefs, I did it very differently from Clement. What I argued is that you have to understand that both Wickard and Filburn and Dole in South Dakota are conceived in original sin, and that therefore you don't want to extend them any further for the reasons that Michael stated. And in fact, if you go back to the entire debate over separation of power, standing and so forth, you can see, starting in about 1920, what they've done in effect is to insulate all the political forces from any external constraints. So they have more that they can bargain over, more that they can bargain with. And the kind of decline that you get from indefinite political right, or indefinite property rights in a political solution, is the kind of thing which has reaped the long-term chaos that we're in. And unless we start right now to understand that this system is completely unsustainable, if we don't put any limitations on the way in which these political situations operate, we're never going to be get out of it. And my plea to the Supreme Court is that they put aside their own kind of orthodoxy, benign, sunny progressivism, and look at this particular thing and say this far and no further. They can distinguish every other spending program under Medicaid, and they should.
Mr. Grieva, a final thought.
I do not think that the Supreme Court will go there, even though it might be desirable. The main function, I think, of considering this particular challenge in this particular case at all is to give justices who want to strike down the individual mandate to look judicious and moderate and middle of the roadish. And even if that's all that this particular challenge does, it will have done its job.
My fear is that we're going to come out worse than we did, because they're going to be completely flaccid about everything.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for your time, and thank you for your thoughts and the insights on this aspect of the Affordable Care Act case. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.